Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to Rule of Three, a podcast about comedy. I'm Jason Hazley.
And I'm Joel Morris.
And as usual, we're joined by someone who makes comedy to talk about something funny that they love. By taking it apart, maybe we'll learn something about how comedy works, or we'll just quote bits from it and giggle until we're finished. Both approaches are valid. Our special guest today is Tom Davis, who is best known for Murder in Successville and Action Team. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Jason. Hello, Joel.
Hello.
Welcome.
You're also well known in the scaffolding industry, I understand.
Oh, massively known. Yeah.
But you got a BAFTA for scaffolding, didn't you, at one point?
Best supporting actor.
It was a scafter.
Best supporting builder. I think I'm the only scaffolder or ex-scaffolder to have been on a BAFTA type stage. I think it's just basically Whitehouse. Paul Whitehouse was a plasterer, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So me and Whitehouse have bonded often on talks of building sites and such.
How did you get from scaffolding to comedy?
Well, James Defon, really. He was James and me have been friends since we were like 13 or 14.
Who directs Successful?
Murder and Successful and Action Team, and now we have Shiny Button together. Which is our company. It does sound a little bit at times like some weird little West End club. I'd sort of put my toe into sort of stand up, and we went out and we used to start making these silly sketches and giving them to people, and Shane Allen and Lee Francis had seen them and they gave us our sort of start, really. It's a weird transition, and up until Murder and Successful, weirdly, I constantly thought, oh, at some point this is all going to just turn to shit and I'm going to be having to go back into the CAF and go, Anyone got any scaffolding work? Still won't happen. It's a great humbler whenever you walk around London, you go to a meeting or whatever and there's some scaffolding going up, and that does spur me on to get as far away from ever having to do it as I can.
It's great. There's the question that you've probably been asked this, certainly know I've been asked it a few times, is how do you get into comedy? And there's never one answer to that. Because all you can do is you can tell people how you got into comedy, you know, because it's all... I was thinking like the Simon Pegg meeting Nick Frost. He was a server in a cafe or something, wasn't he? And Simon said, this is just one of the funniest guys I've ever met. So just get him on board. And suddenly, he's a great actor and he's a great comic. You can come in from any direction.
And I think it's weirdly the people that you sort of find. I mean, I still look at scaffolding and think some of the funniest people that I've ever met or ever worked with, you know, are from that background. Like my dad is a very sort of blue collar guy. He's one of the funniest people, he knows exactly what he does and almost plays a character now at times but I constantly get asked it by, especially now, younger kids. And weirdly, the thing about it is pretty much is hard work and luck. Constantly.
You need both.
One doesn't work with the other, because you see a lot of hard working people who don't get anywhere. and you see a lot of lucky people who get a chance and somehow mess it up because they don't work hard enough. But I always just think if you get up and you know, like you two are great inspiration on that, you get up, and even if you're looking for other avenues, if stand-up isn't going great, you know, or you haven't got a script that's going on, you should be at all times pushing angles so you've got work coming in, because this is a full-time job, and we've all got wives, kids to feed, so you have to look at it like that. It's, you know, I think with you guys with books and whatever, you two are always busy, and there's a reason for that, because you've worked hard enough to be in a place that people want to work with you. I mean, you're lovely blokes for most part.
He's nice. I like him.
He can come back.
But no, you know, but that hard work and that luck, and they're important. And that
someone said to me that what you should be is you should be hardworking enough so that when you're lucky enough to be asked to do something, you're able to do it.
Yeah.
So basically, when someone comes and asks you to do something, it shouldn't be the first time you've ever done it. As in, you did it a lot of times for no money first, so that when someone comes to pay you money for it, you turn out to be surprisingly good at it. And that's where the luck turns into sort of
career. That's just being match fit, isn't it, basically?
Yeah, that's what happened with me. Was me and James had been out doing these videos that, you know, we were kind of doing it. James wanted to direct, I wanted to act. And then when Lee Francis was doing Shimon Selector, which was the sort of death of that character, Michael Jackson had died, he was doing a death of that character. He had seen these videos and he turned around and said, "Look, Tom, I want you to play John Landis." And it was the first thing I'd ever done. And I sort of came in, and because I'd done so much stuff just making these videos with James, I sort of knew how to, because being on stage is one thing, but then working the camera and knowing how to work in front of, if I'd never done it before, all those times for free, I'd have fallen apart. You know, I wouldn't have, I was a bit sort of match ready, really. No, I still feel lucky, and I feel humbled that every day I get up and this is my job. You know, I get to mess around with you guys in a room when we're doing Murder and Successful. Lots of people I work with now are close friends, and that is certainly anything that I've sort of made that's been a product of sort of Murder and Successful, Action Team, or that, you know, even with when I was in Paddington with Paul and people, that it's really hard to turn that on, that sense of fun and that sense of comedy and that sense of, and Paul King actually is a really good guy at doing that. He makes everyone feel so comfortable.
It's amazing. But the huge production he's trying to keep on the rails, and he's still so nice, and it's still
coming
so
over,
fun
having a joke, making you comfortable. And it weirdly, you can't just turn on that kind of, that's the episodes of Murder and Successful I'll look at and go, well, they weren't as good. Are usually episodes where the people behind the scenes, like just between scenes, weren't as much fun as, you know, Deborah Meaden was. You know, as people will say, oh, she took that really seriously. I was like, well, she was fantastic. But actually, when the cameras weren't rolling, she was inquisitive, she was joking, she was really having a good time. It's because you can't turn that on. You can't. Mm. Everyone needs to be enjoying themselves, whether it's scripted, improvised, whatever it is. And I think you can always see, and I can certainly see the stuff that I've been in, that I've turned up on the day, and there's just this air of no one having fun, and it's, this is just a job, let's just do it. And
it's lightning in a bottle, you're trying to capture something. But the real magic is when the camera or the microphone catches an inescapable feeling of everyone rolling into laughter or trying to hold it in. And Successful's brilliant for that, because it actually has got a whole cast of people who are trying to keep something on the rails that at any moment could collapse into giggles.
It constantly feels like it's going to fall apart. But weirdly,
do you push it towards collapse when you're doing it?
Yeah. Like if you say capturing lightning in a bottle, the only way of doing that is sort of creating a storm, in a sense, where you're going to get it. And
true.
That's in a sense what Successful is. Because along with the lightning, you're getting rain and you're getting hailstones, and sometimes things aren't working. I mean, like, I think the thing that made the show, I'd sat with you guys have come up with the Jamie Lang, me in his ear. And it was obviously always a funny joke, and we had funny stuff. We knew the Optimus Prime stuff, Optimus Prime stuff was funny. We knew all that was great. And that scene where he says about the pigeon and the stone, that went on for like, I think we were just recording for like 10 minutes of just chatting and me pinging stuff at him and seeing how he acts. The moment I turned around and said, you know, you kill a slug. And it was that moment where you're like, everything else is unusable. It's just nothing. But that throwing enough at it, enough shit at the wall, if you want, for that thing to be the thing that made the show work. And you're forever then going, actually, sometimes we're going to run these scenes for ages. You know, you see members of the crew going, you know, fucking hell, how many things are going to throw at this? But in my head, I go to every scene going, right, I need that thing.
A nugget of gold is going
to
bite.
And every episode has to have that laugh. And that's what the beauty of it, and that that set the standard, really.
And having the faith to keep pushing it out. I'm talking to Diane Morgan about doing Kunk. When she does the interviews with the experts, they are often an hour long, because you're not wasting an expert's time. If you book them, you use them for as long as you've got them for. You've got an hour of talking to them, asking them stupid questions as they get tireder and tireder. And it will be very often for the series we just did with the history thing, for one line, for less than like 10 seconds. But as long as you know you're going to get that 10 seconds, and it's somewhere in there, to have the faith to keep pushing, that then edits down, the expert looks good, Diane looks good, the script looks good, but you've recorded so much to get there, and it was just not losing faith that goal was in there somewhere.
You're going to get that fit, and that's what I love about that new Kunk series, and what I did one of my first ever jobs with Diane, and she's just a remarkable talent.
Great, isn't she?
She's fantastic. Brilliant. But what I love about what the Kunk thing is, and what we did when Successful, is it's never making the other people look stupid.
No.
Like, the joke's always on Diane or me. I think our generation, there was, people would sort of run before us, there'd been that sort of thing of like these, you know, hidden camera shows where people would do some pretty atrocious things. I know I was always really against that thing. I did a pilot once where we had to go into a restaurant and stage this big argument type thing, and everyone in there is like a real punter. And I was like, I don't think I can do this. Because we've all signed up. We all want to be comedians. We all want to be on TV. But there could be a guy in there who's breaking up with a girl. There could be a family who've just lost someone. We don't know. Have you been for every table? No, you haven't, because it's meant to be a surprise. So I can't do this. And they were like, you know, and in the end, I got another guy to do it. The joke can never be on them. It has to be, I've signed that contract to go, I'll always be the fool. I'll always be the idiot. They shouldn't have to be. I think that's important. I think that's important with comedy in general, to remember who wants to be the butt of the joke.
Yeah.
And who, sometimes who's forced to be. And I think that's an important thing. I think that the worst part of it was that I'm obsessed with watching Bullseye back. My honeymoon, my wife got really bad food poisoning, and I sat and watched Bullseye. The moment when people would come onto that show, they just went for pretty much a good time. And that thing at the end, it goes, have you had a great day? Oh, we've had a great day out, Jim. We had a great day out. And that's been lost now, because you wouldn't get those sorts of people, those characters on something, because I've done shows now where they're like, oh, we've got a member of the public. And the guy turns up, and I'm like, you know, he's been on TV more than I have. I've seen him on three or four different things. He's got a fucking bigger IMDb than anyone I know. Now everyone knows how to work a camera phone. Everyone knows how, like, I could film anyone in the street. They've done stuff, you know, they've done a message for their grand. They know almost how to play their version of them in front of camera. So you never get that real thing. Like, you know, you watch those old episodes of Bullseye, people are going, and gulping and not knowing quite what to say, and standing in, they're not camera savvy, so you'll get Jim pulling them around and going, no, you're not going to stand there. And there's a beautiful thing in it, you know. Someone asked me a number of years ago about would I want to do a remake of that, you know, Bullseye, if they brought it back, would you do it? And I was like, but it would never be the same. Just that's one thing, leave it where it is, because actually the old ones are as entertaining as anything.
So, obviously, Tom, you brought for us Bullseye as your thing to look at.
I could have brought Bullseye.
Tell us what you brought from the world of comedy for us to have a look at.
I've brought the last ever episode of Wonder Years. It's something that, weirdly, and it's, I sort of see everywhere, like in lots of different things I do, it's one of the few things that sort of stayed with me as that. I watched it when it came out, and I probably watched it once since. And it's this I have this beautiful memory of it, but it's the only time I can ever really remember a sitcom or something as like that being sort of finished off in such a perfect way. And also finished off in a time where I was almost growing old enough to walk away from giving my life to Wonder Years. It was the tea time show that you'd watched over 6 years. And then to go, right, well, I'm going to, you know.
What would you do if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears.
One of the reasons that the Wonder Years finished, it did six seasons. It was a single camera American family coming of age sitcom set in the late 60s, early 70s. And they finished it after six seasons. And one of the reasons they gave was that the kid was growing up to a point that showing his life aged 18 would have been a post-watershed show. It would have to stop when he stopped being suitable for family viewing.
And then weirdly, that last episode, it was kind of, that last episode was just the stuff he's doing in it. And that was almost them saying, like, yeah, this is the end of his childhood. This is the last times that he's ever going to listen to his dad. And for the most part, his dad had been this sort of, you know, everything his dad said when he was his daddy's boy type thing. And that sort of moment, he rebels against his dad in that episode.
In the most amazing way, in the opening where he rejects his dad's bag of pants. Which I think you're doing the cards on the wall for what the scenes are. Yeah. Right. Reject dad's bag of pants is a pretty definitive index card in any plot. It's in Save the Cat. It's a classic plot.
It's a massive plot line anywhere.
It all happened in Star Wars. Darth would give him a bag of
Luke,
pants.
These are your pants.
No!
I was in the only relationship with my dad where I knew that sort of I'd grown up, you know, of an age where he started having my hand-me-downs. Like my dad would, God. Yeah. Like he started wearing my old school blazers to weddings. Like he just took took the badge off them. Like, that's fine. We've got another 3 years out of this. Yeah.
Well, my mum gave me one of my dad's suits once and said, "You'll like this. It's a really nice suit, you know." And I said, "Oh, thanks very much." Yeah, and I unzipped this thing from his suit bag. And I said, when did he last wear this? And she said, "Oh, I think it was, what was that conference he went to? 1973? And it was this burgundy suit with like lapels the size of airplane wings, you know. It was just this gigantic thing, and I thought, there's no way I can't even wear this ironically. It isn't even possible to be ironic in this suit, because there is no way I can wear this without basically just plastering myself in total ridicule. It can't be done. And Old Spice, yeah, obviously. Do you know what struck me about this? Is the same thing that you just lighted on then. It's really hard to do a last episode of a sitcom, because a sitcom is a loop. You have to reset the characters and go back to where they started every week. And if you try and then impose an ending on it, it looks arch. But fucking hell, this one is done so well. Man. This might be the best last episode of a sitcom I've ever seen.
Because when I was chatting to you boys about doing this, I looked at this and I looked at Quantum Leap as the two. And actually, so when I was looking at them, and Quantum Leap is actually not finished. I don't know if you know the ending of it. He lets Al return to his normal life.
Right.
But then Sam Beckett goes back, and it's like Sam Beckett, you know, Al settled down, he had three kids, da-da-da. Sam Beckett never returned home. So in exactly that thing, you're like, well, this isn't over then.
Yeah, the loop's still open. Yeah.
It's still going. Whereas, like, in Wonder Years, it's like a rubber stamp of like, this is it. This is the end type thing. That beautiful, I mean, I used to know it off by heart, but that beautiful, the end speech that he does about his dad. Incredible.
The weight of it, I timed it, and the amount of narrative weight that's on the last 3 minutes of the show.
Yeah.
And then you look within that, and the amount of narrative weight that's on the last 60 seconds.
Yes.
It's holding you in a state of suspension about what's going to happen next, about who's going to get who, about what's going to happen in the future to all these people, because you watch them grow up. And until almost the last second, you're still not sure about anyone. Yeah. And then it finishes and you go,
The lovely bit of, because you've heard this guy speaking for 6 years, the old Kevin Arnold.
Talking about his past, basically.
And then that moment of him, you know, a house like any house and a yard like any yard. And I look back in wonder. And then you get the thing of going, hey, Dad, are you going to come out? I'll be right there.
And the thing is, after all these years, I still look back with wonder.
Hey Dad, wanna play catch?
I'll be right there.
Because weirdly, they copied it for Eastbound and Down, pretty much.
They do it again.
The end of Eastbound and Down is him at the typewriter.
All the way through, you've heard one voice, and there's no idea that there's a life.
And what I loved
happening
is,
now.
Also, what I loved is the fact that moment when the camera's pulling out, and it's like he's in a house talking to his dad, and he says, "A house like any house, a yard like any yard." And what's a great thing is at that moment you go, "Oh, is that your house as a kid that we were looking at,
now.
Or your house now that we're looking at?"
I think I watched the Wonder Years when it was first on. I don't think I watched to the end. So this is the first time I'd seen the finale. And I was thinking, God, it's set 68 to 73, and there's lots of period detail in it. But the reason I think it was accessible to a British audience, and obviously in America it's going to be huge, it's got a sort of Peanuts vibe to it, like growing up in the Midwest, in the suburbs. But when it pulls out at the end and it shows you that road, you go, that's the road from E.T., that's Spielberg's. This is now and then. And Spielberg's suburbia is the suburbia of his childhood, even though it's set in the 80s. And the fact that Fred Savage looks a bit like Henry Thomas from E.T., this is a world I completely recognise, because I'd lived so much through the childhood of Spielberg movies,
yeah.
Poltergeist, those kind of things, that I recognise that street even though I didn't grow up there. I know the layout of an American house.
It's a weird thing that when you're growing up in England as well, and you're, you know, I didn't grow up in anything as sort of twee as that, that becomes almost something that you look at as... I remember watching The Wonder Years and thinking, oh man, I'd love his life. Mm. You know, and
yeah. I always wanted a big basement with things
I mean, that moment where he used to go, and also, you know, his relationship with Paul. And
you're right in saying it hasn't dated.
No.
And the reason it hasn't dated, I think, is this is the beginning of making sitcoms like this, with no laugh track, single camera, with a drama, with warmth, with sentiment. And it's influenced everything. I kept thinking how much it reminded me of adverts. Now use this language, which is the passage of time, the vision of a family. When they're trying to sell you banking, or they're always showing you a family through the years, and you go, and it punches you in the guts like a John Lewis advert. It's the same techniques, the music, the acoustic guitar. It's like a John Lewis Christmas advert.
I could never remember, I mean, maybe, but like anyone using that voiceover as much as they...
No.
I mean, there's a great, I think it's in maybe the series before the last one, he gets the job in the hardware store and all his other friends have got better jobs and he's got this old guy. And again, what they did so brilliantly is they made the sweetness of things where, you know, I think the old guy dies and you know, and Kevin's basically sort of feels guilty because he's left the place. And it really did that thing of, and you know, you could watch that with such sort of cynicism and I embrace it. I think it's so, the last moments where he's sort of talking about him and Winnie. And, you know, and I mean, this isn't a spoiler, but God, it's 20 years old if you want
to. We can do
the
spoiler, because we've got to talk about the ending of this. Yeah. And I think the way it plays that out, because it's a will they, won't they story. Yeah. Winnie is his sweetheart. Yeah. They've been running 6 years, will they, won't they? And right till the end, because you think this is the episode, they do a bottle episode. They trap him and Winnie in a car. And then to make the car even worse, they both get thrown out of the car on the side of the road. And you go, right, now we're going to see the two characters we wanted to know. Do they get together? Yeah. Close up, trapped together for the last 15 minutes of the episode, and right till the end, you think they're going to split up.
And then you have that beautiful moment of, in the VO where he's like, you know, when he goes off to Paris, right?
Yeah. Oh,
and
God.
Winnie left the next summer to study art history in Paris. Still, we never forgot our promise. We wrote to each other once a week for the next 8 years. I was there to meet her when she came home with my wife and my first son, 8 months old.
What I love.
Things never turn out the way you planned.
What a great line.
And it's almost like he's talking to the audience and saying, I know you wanted this to happen, but in reality, this is my first love.
Yeah.
It won't necessarily be my last love.
And also that moment comes, like in this montage at the end, like his brother goes to Harvard and his sister Karen has a baby and things. And in the middle of the montage, he kills his dad.
Yeah.
Oh, and dad died two years later of cancer. Yeah. You're going, whoa!
Yeah. And his dad's still on the screen. Yeah. And you realise that his dad, you do the maths in your head and realise that his dad would have been a granddad for about a year.
Yeah.
And the tragedy of him seeing
and
his dad
become
a granddad.
And the moment when he says that and he's sitting opposite his dad and you see, because what I loved about it is they never made it too schmaltzy I have that relationship with my dad. I've let my dad down. I look at it sometimes and think, when I look at that Wonder Years, and you never necessarily sit and go, you'll say, I'm sorry for being a dick, but you don't sit and talk about it sometimes. You just know that you really mean that. And actually what's great is that last moment where you just see them both having a Coke and neither of them have said this, you know, when he first turns up at the 4th of July and they just nod at each other and there's a really sweet, sweet moment between them. But then they're just sitting there and it's all been forgotten and they're laughing and it's perfectly written chat that you have with your dad of that, you know, you're going to be a granddad, grey hairs a lot, and he's just like, laughing. And what was brilliant with that as a character, his dad, and over the years, is weirdly the mum grew loads. She was really like, and Wayne, his brother, grew, and his sister, you know, went from being like these sort of like this free, you know, free love sort of hippie type thing to sort of a, you know, but weirdly his dad was almost, the world changed, and it's still now with men, is that years and years ago a guy didn't have to do anything really around the house. You went to work, you put your feet up, you didn't do your washing, you didn't do it, but also more than that, if stuff got, you didn't almost argue, because if things got too annoying at home, you'd just go out to the pub. And it was a really, but it's like, you know, and now, you know, and rightly so, we're all in touch more with, you know, you wouldn't cry, you wouldn't, you know, you just get on with it, because that's what everyone had done, and especially a guy like that, you just go out and go, right, fuck it, I'm going to, you know, do what I'm going to do. And now we all, I suffer anxiety. I'm constantly in tune with how I'm feeling.
Yeah.
So, and I'll, but guys of that generation aren't. Guys of that generation were told not to. It was kind of, and what I love about that show is that they kept him almost the same through it all.
The one person who didn't ask any questions, the one person who didn't change.
But the one person, weirdly, when the chips were down, you'd always see the dad come in, and he'd never say, he'd never shout at him, he'd never be, it was like, he was always sort of there, but he'd never sort of explain it as much as he probably could. And it's a really interesting thing of a blue-collar character that just sort of, is there and muddling by the best he can. And he's sort of, I feel probably up there with my favourite sitcom characters.
There's an episode in the first series where he goes to work with his dad, doesn't he? To find out, because he says to his dad, what do you do all day? And he says, shovel other people's crap so you can eat. So he goes to his dad's office with him and he sees his dad, who is the head of the family, who's the guy in charge, being bawled out by his appalling boss. And then you realise, oh fuck, this is what this guy, the dad, brings home with him every day, the fact that he gets treated like crap at work, doesn't he? And then you think, wow, there's a whole midlife crisis sitcom going on in here in the background, with a minor character.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time. The world's best converting checkout. Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify. Start your dollar a month trial today at shopify.com/records.
But weirdly, I look at the work that, and the characters I love to play and the characters I love to write, and actually I think it all kind of started with sitting watching Kevin Arnold, because what was great is that he wasn't wacky, he wasn't like, he was a put upon, even as a kid he was like kind of self-deprecating. Like the misfit, the loser. What was beautiful, and I kind of suffered from that, I guess, he was just trying to find his place in the world. And when he started secondary school was kind of his first sort of series, or he wasn't a jock, he wasn't a brainy kid, he was just this kid trying to find where he fitted in. And that was a beautiful, such a well-observed thing, that it's timeless, really.
What it's got, I suppose, and why it's probably a revolutionary sitcom in the sense of now, when you look, I think when you look at a sitcom now, you can see the effect this must have had on American sitcom. Because it's not an audience, it's not studio. The closest thing, I think, immediately preceding this would probably be Roseanne.
Yeah.
For getting a family, I mean, the dad, the patriarch, the sort of the gentle, helpful, but sort of rock-like man in the middle of it. Lots of it shares with that. And then you can see the line straight through from this to Malcolm in the Middle and Freaks and Geeks and loads of shows that have got its DNA in it. But I think what's interesting about it is it doesn't have big, wacky characters in it, which would have been essentials for any sitcom that was relying on a laugh track.
Yeah, I mean, it was a weird thing as well. Chris Rock did his show, Everyone Hates Chris, it was literally, right, this is works, let's just do our version of it.
Yeah.
Can't break it.
Even if you looked at Superbad and anything like the films that I love now, these films sort of have those moments. And
there's even the grammar of it reminded, when I was watching it, I thought, fuck, I've heard some of these lines in Scrubs. Yeah. Which is very similar. That even those lines, and there you had it. You know, and you go, well, that's a line. That Scrubs borrowed that line. You know, and then it hit me. You go, this stuff was ported into.
People used to pastiche it and go, and that's when I knew I'd come full circle. It's the classic Wonder Years line. But that VO, which I think I was trying to think of a sitcom that had a voiceover before, and I think they wrote this originally as a screenplay, as for a film, and the VO is fairly common in that. But I think this is the thing that breaks open the possibilities of treating a sitcom like a novel. It's like a coming of age novel. There's a narrator's voice, which you then hear in Arrested Development and Scrubs and things, as a way of getting an extra layer of jokes and also just moving the action at an extra pace, because that helps it go faster. You can tell people are thinking. It's a bit of an internal monologue, and that's how you can end up with something here which I think is enormously influential, which is the short drama, half-hour drama. This is a comedy, but it tells you a story over 22 minutes, which is basically what Netflix is full of, these little half-hour dramas. It's the future of storytelling.
Of course, not on Netflix. And the other thing I find is it's kind of weirdly, actually, it's so in those 6 years that he grows, his life becomes less funny. Life is significantly more funny when you're 10 than when you're 16.
How old were you when you started watching this then?
I must have been, I think
about
it was
the right age.
Yeah, about the right. It must have been secondary school. I remember like coming home, and I remember it being on, it was on Channel 4, I believe, on that sort of tea time slot where Hollyoaks and things sit now. And it was religious viewing. Even I think if you watch The Simpsons, there's elements of...
I think there's a line through there as well.
Yeah, and weirdly, so when we were doing Successville, we were always... Because you're never sure if you're ever going to do another series. Sort of. Series 1, we kind of knew there was a Series 2. Series 2, we didn't. So we ended it with him getting shot and then having the scene with Kerry Godleman. And then the final series... Well, not the final series, I shouldn't say that. The last series on BBC Three that we've done, we were like, right, how do we end this? And I was like... Oh, we should end it like Wonder Years, like that really. So it's him and Ramsay having this long discussion about life, and as Ramsay leaves, like, hey Ramsay, if you ever have a son and he burns a hole in your carpet in the living room, just go easy on him, huh? It's a line from Back to the Future. Which I just love the fact you throw that in, and it just had this, because weirdly the idea of sleep playing it like it was the last episode that he'd know about, and then switching all the lights off and
playing with ideas of warmth now, because this feels like you've seen this, everyone is attempting this where they always say what likability and warmth in our characters. This is doing it almost like, feels like, for the first time. It feels really fresh. The strange thing is watching it and trying to remember that this wasn't how sitcoms were done. They'd done moments like this in Cheers and in MASH and things like that, but always with a laugh track and an audience behind it, and it didn't feel like watching a movie.
Because the final Cheers was Sam switching the lights off in the bar, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was, again, something that we looked at. But I think the Wonder Years' thing for me is it's like that. Yeah, like now where we're in a world where we're starting to go, right, how do we do something that's a bit more mainstream? How do we go into a world of doing that? And if I was to go, like, what's the best thing that I think depicts, like, how I grew up, like, my family, would be The Wonder Years. I look at it and I think, even though it's a million miles away, I look at it and think, I was kind of that kid. I had
trouble.
Can relate
to it.
And then my dad was kind of like him. My mum was, she was a nurse who worked for the NHS, but then from there she set up, like, a gardening business, and she was sort of dynamically going out and was, you know, she became like a like work of the Labour Party, and she was out and about, you know, which when you grew up in an area that I did, which was pretty much all Conservative, was like the worst thing.
Are you going to come home, Mum?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're like, don't safe? Do this. She was like, Neil Kinnock needs his word. We need to spread the word of Neil Kinnock, and everyone else is a Thatcherite in South London. It's like, fuck off. Your mum was around our house last night telling us to vote for Kinnock, and you're like, oh, God. You get the feeling that when they were writing that, they were looking back at their lives in the 60s and the 70s. And now when we look at the 90s, and it feels like, you know, 80s, 90s feels like so long ago, like,
oh God,
and
yeah,
how much culturally we've changed. But they were on the precipice of change then, and by the time this was out, you know, they'd sort of found their place in the world. But the 60s and 70s in America was more important, arguably, than any other time in American history. It was
so you've got a very mainstream show aimed at a very family audience, but it can have all this stuff in it about, like Mad Men can, about the change of the times and things.
But with the writing as well, you're not sitting there and it's not swearing, it's not, you're asking questions, you know, constantly. And what it did brilliantly was that could be asked within that household. Like, the father stood for one thing, the mother stood for another, but then even as it went down, the sister and the brother were completely, you know, the brother was like, you know, almost, you know, like would be our version of, you know, Thatcherite, you know, he was sort of living the American dream, where his sister was, you know, anti-war and I suppose like a hippie, and
so you have the Woodstock arguments within,
so
within
you've constantly got, and then in the center of it all, you've got Kevin, who's going, oh, I don't really know what I want to be or who I want to be. So he's everywhere around him is culture clashes, you know. And I remember there'd be scenes where they just, it's him and his dad playing basketball in the backyard, and there's a weird part of the Wonder Years where sometimes I'll think of a memory and then I'll go, cool, was that from, because we after, with the Wonder Years being on and like being tall and gangly, I insisted upon having a basketball ring put in our back garden
because you knew you'd win
against anyone else.
These are going to be easy fucking hoops, no problem.
So and then I used to sort of try and sort of have moments where me and my dad could sort of have
you'd stay used to Wonder Years.
And my dad would go, I'm not playing that, I'll just get a fucking goal out and do football. But or having to explain the rules, which is a bit, you never saw it. No, you know, like, that's 3 points. But there's something lovely about those, that sort of sitting back and remembering that as a show.
It was a pretty hard pass.
Well, I think it had sort of a reverse spin on it.
Come on, Kevin, stop gabbing with your girlfriend.
She's not my girlfriend.
It's interesting you sort of saying about you growing up in somewhere that's very different in terms of what it looks like and the era and everything, but somehow the truth of the show is that family dynamic feels real, that you can recognise it. And I had the same relationship growing up with Peanuts, with Schultz comics. I used to read them and think, that's my life, even though none of the details of it were like my life. And I wonder whether some of it is to do with whether it's through the eyes of a child, and most sitcoms about families before this would have been through the eyes of the parents, and the children would have been side characters. And what this has got in common with Peanuts, it's from a child's eye view, and the grown-ups are a bit wah-wah-wah-wah-wah, slightly out of view in the background like they are. And that's only possible if you've got a single-camera show because of child labour laws. You can't keep the kids up late night recording a sitcom in front of an audience, but you can get Fred Savage on set to have the whole thing through a child's eye if it's made like a film.
Yeah.
And it feels like I was watching it again and thinking, this is quite remarkable as a family sitcom, in that you could watch it as a kid, but it's not a children's programme. It's for the whole family. And maybe that's what feels real, is that the experience of being a kid's pretty much the same anywhere.
Because I remember watching it with my parents and them, like, you know, enjoying it as much. But that's, I guess that's the exact point of it, right? Is before that, you know, everyone loves Raymond or whatever, was so much from Ray's point of view. And if you're watching that as a youngster, Fred Savage in it is incredible.
He's the youngest actor to win an Emmy for Best Actor.
Really? Rightly so, because his way of conveying the different emotions of a kid of that age, and weirdly, I think the first two series are quite, they're quite funny, and you're a bit like Diary of a Wimpy Kid or whatever. Mm. And I think there must have been a moment where they were like, wow, this kid can really go to different places as an actor. And I remember sort of series 3 or 4, they're like ladling on these really big like emotional scenes. And then you think, fine, that, like, Christ, like, because he was obviously in The Princess Bride. He was amazing in that. But then you think, what happened there? He directs now, doesn't he? He directs a Modern
He's
Family.
He's in production and he directs, he's behind the camera now.
He directs Modern Family. He's directed three or four big episodes of that.
It's almost like he knows how to make sitcoms.
Because weirdly, his episode of Modern Family, from what I remember, is the first one he directed was the episode with Phil Dunphy and his dad, who's played by Fred Willard, and it has smacks of the Wonder Years all over it. Really, because actually, weirdly, actually, there's one show that you can look at and go, that makes me feel exactly how the Wonder Years used to, is Modern Family.
So with sitcoms, very often there's a lot of stress on the set, and people will say, I've had a great idea for a sitcom, and why has no one done one set in a vet's?
Yeah.
And you go, well, the idea, the set doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because they're all about families in one sort or another, whether it's The Young Ones or Fawlty Towers. They're about a dysfunctional family of some sort. Yeah. So basically, if you've got what is the most vanilla form of sitcom you can do, which is the family sitcom, then the question is not what's it about, but how do you make it? What's the form?
And also, who's in it?
Yeah.
Who are
casting,
the people?
Craft.
But the characters, it's like, you have to, like, I think when the great sitcoms that I can think of, you know, Fools and Horses or Modern Family, when you open your door and you, it's where I think soap has started to fall apart. Because you're opening your door to these things and you're saying, right, I'm going to spend time with these people. So actually, they've got to be people that you want to spend time with.
Yeah.
Mm.
Or they've got to stir an emotion, whether it's love or hate, they're annoying, or that you want to be them, whatever. And I think that the Modern Family actually is almost up there for me with Wonder Years. But the characters are so well-defined. They're so brilliant. Phil Dunphy's is incredible.
But you want to spend time with them.
Yeah.
That question. Yeah. A friend of mine is a film lecturer came up with this brilliant theory, which I've not heard before, so it might be his. Called Andrew Mayo, who sort of lectures in film as a film journalist. And he said there's two sorts of film story you can tell. One's a horizontal story, which is the kind of the hero's journey. They go for a mission. They go to find the secret papers and bring it back. Yeah. That thing, which is always taught in film schools. So then the other story is a vertical story where not much happens. But in the opening scene, you meet some people and you go, I like them. And the next scene is another reason that you like them.
Yeah.
And the next scene is another reason that you like them. And you hope they might fall in love or rob the bank. And then by the end of it, you really, really like them. And all it is a pile of reasons you like them. And oddly, something like Butch and Sundance is just a pile of reasons why these guys are nice. Or With Nan and I, a bunch of reasons you want to hang out with these people. And there's something about sitcom as a story form that doesn't have a beginning, middle and an end, where sometimes its best form is just a bunch of reasons you enjoy hanging out with Del Boy and Rodney.
Yeah.
Will do as a story.
Yeah. But that's the thing sometimes is, I mean, I'm sure you guys have been talked to about, you know, about scripts, and I've certainly been set stuff that's like, oh, this thing's set in a pub, or this thing's set in, you know, a garage or whatever it is. And you actually sit and look at it and you think, well, that's fine. You've got the setting, but none of these people feel like they've got any love in there. You haven't sat there and crafted the characters. You haven't.
Yeah.
They're not people you know, or they're not people you feel you know, or the people you want to know.
And they've got to give a shit about each other, haven't they? That's the really key thing.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
It's exactly it. It's the fact that it's a similar relationship, I guess, the dad from granddad now in Modern Family. His relationship with Phil, his son-in-law, you know, he loves him, but he finds him frustratingly annoying. As soon as you get married, you realise that your relationship with your father-in-law is exactly that. You know, they've brought this girl up, they've given her, you know, their advice, they've hoped that she's going to follow along, and now they're putting her into your capable hands. My father-in-law constantly questions every choice I make, down to, like, if I turn around and go, oh, we're going to Portugal for on holiday, and he's like, oh, yeah? Why are you going there? You know, why don't you go to Seville? You know, have you thought about going to Seville?
Because we're not going with you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Anymore.
Yeah, and I'm sort of...
Not like, after last time.
There's a weird relationship between me and him, and that's what I love about Modern Family, and I think when Karen first gets a boyfriend in Wonder Years, it's that thing of him being like, no one's ever going to be good enough. So
for
the first time, you're the guy, he's looking up going, I mean, for me, from when I brought Catherine, my wife, home, my parents were like, to her, are you sure? Like,
that's always a nice moment.
Have you checked everything else on the shelf? You're sticking here on 13.
The other great thing that this does in its ending is it gives you the ending that you think the audience would go, no, they're meant to get together, you know, they're meant to get together, and they don't, but it's still a happy ending.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what it reminded me of. It's only just occurred to me. There's a if you've never seen it, you should look at it. There's a great film that was made for Channel 4 in 1984, written by Jack Rosenthal, called Patangyang Kippabang. Incredible title.
Yeah, one of the first things ever on Channel 4.
Yeah, one of the probably on the opening night, Channel 4 maybe. And it's a young boy who's about 13 or 14, and he's in love with a girl in his class, and he really wants to kiss her, but he's obviously never going to get anywhere near her because he has clammy hands and that kind of thing, you know. And he eventually ends up accidentally falling into the school play with her, and he gets a scene where he has to kiss her. And they go into rehearsals, and every time they get to the kiss, the teacher says, right, okay, move on, next scene. So he's only got one chance to kiss her, and it's in the actual performance in front of the whole school. He gets a chance, and he can't bring himself to do it, so he just shakes her hand instead of kissing her. And it's lovely, because at the end, she then chases him after the play and says, why didn't you kiss me? Don't you like me? And he's overwhelmed with feelings for her. He can't bring himself to kiss her. He just can't do it. It's absolutely beautiful. And they do the same thing then. It's a happy ending. At the very end, there's a cricket commentator, a very famous one, his name, I can't remember now. Jack.
John
Arlott, that's it, saying he went to the wicket a boy and came away a man. You know, it's wonderful. Because, but he's happy with it because he's sort of grown up in some sense, even though he didn't get the thing that you think was the only thing he wanted.
It's the way to it's the way you can play a will they, won't they, especially in a coming of age thing, where the point is your first romance probably won't be the one that lasts forever. And they play it brilliantly in here because you want them to not be together, even though you want them to be together. And especially because he's got this beautiful line that Winnie says, at the moment, the hinge where they've rejected each other, they've fallen out, and he thinks, well, that's it, we're never even going to be friends. And he sees she's crying, she says, I don't want it to end.
Yeah.
And part of you goes, that's the relationship. And part of you goes, as an audience member for the Wonder Years, I don't want it to end.
Yeah.
It's the feeling everyone has in the last episode of a show. And she's saying, this show is running on the motor of us two.
Yeah.
And if we stop being friends, this show's over, but we don't have to fall in love and have kids. We just have to end on good
terms.
What's
lovely is the bit of it that he's written to her, and you kind of know at some point in those letters, one of them said, I've met someone else.
Yeah.
And this is, I've moved on.
Yeah.
And it's that beautiful thing of, anyone you sort of look at, like the first person you loved, and the first, I weirdly bumped into that girl not so long ago. And you're like, Christ, thank God.
Well, for both of us.
There's
a brilliant one of these, a show that's enormously indebted to the Wonder Years, which is Freaks and Geeks, which I adore. And the brilliant thing with the dream girl in that, where they play that for 17 episodes. And then towards the end, he finally goes on a date with her. She's the cheerleader. The whole setup's been, he's going to get her. And he takes her to go and see Steve Martin's The Jerk. And she sits there going, why are you watching this stupid film? Why is that man doing stupid stuff? And he realises she's the worst woman in the world for him. And they bother to play that. And he goes, oh, I'm not better than her, but all that putting her on a pedestal thing was worthless because I never knew her. We'd never spoken. The whole point of this is I didn't know who she was.
Yeah.
Now I know who she is. I realised that we're not meant for each other. And they played that for 16, 17 episodes, the whole series, and it ended the same way as this, going, maybe we have to move on.
But what's interesting, because that is, again, so brilliant, but never had that ending. Like, or never, certainly never let, people who were in it and wrote it have done okay since. They've nicked a living. But they've been, but you think, God, like, if that had given that chance for that to grow.
Uniquely, they knew they were going to get cancelled from about show 5, Freaks and Geeks.
Did
they wrote episode 17 and go, well, this could be episode 28 or it could be episode 10. We don't know. And they had it ready to go so that it would end with, again, a very Wonder Years influenced ending where they all go off and you see what they're going to do. And they move off, but they had it written so that when they went, the axe fell, they still got a chance to make it.
It's also, weirdly,
Tom's broken the furniture.
It's also, weirdly, when you've seen the ending of The Wonder Years, it gives you something that you want everything to have answers at the end of a film. So, for example, Three Billboards. I love that film. I thought it was brilliant, but there's a part of me that wanted a Wonder Years ending. I wanted to know what happened when they're in that car. I wanted answers. I wasn't enough
it
for me.
Be a service you can sign up for.
Me and Sam Rockwell drove 200 miles and we killed that paedophile dad. It's weirdly Shawshank Redemption as that exact voice for that whole thing. That whimsical sort of...
Again, that's from a book. I think the thing that makes this great is that this, as a genre, the coming-of-age American novel is a pretty big thing, and this is done as a sitcom. It's shoved those two things together. It's even got the thing that is in all American coming of age dramas, is working at a resort, which appears to be a thing that all Americans do. I never worked at a resort, but everyone in every novel I've read worked at a resort or an adventure park or something, and it's even got that in it. But it's got whiffs of that thing, and that author's voice is very classic American coming of age novel. Odd, that story can never get old, and I think that's the universal thing that means it's set in any town USA. Deliberately, don't name where it is, but it's anywhere if you were broadly sort of that class or age.
Also globally, I think. There's moments of it that it could be any of us. It's one of those nice things that you can think that there was writer's rooms on that thing where people were just throwing in their ideas and something that's happened. As I say, we're doing a similar thing at the moment, and it has what you realise is you sit down with me, James, Andy, and we had a writer in the other day from the States, and as soon as he sits down with us and we're sort of talking about, you know, one of us, Andy, going to a Christian camp and all the other cool kids went to Glastonbury, it's weirdly something that hits a chord with all of us. You're like, oh yeah, that thing happened to me, something like that happened to me, and whether you're from America or wherever you're from, everyone knows that feeling of not getting the girl or not being there for the coolest moment.
I was remembering the other day that when I was young, all my mates had gone to Scouts and they're having a great time. So I mentioned this to my mum and she announced proudly some few weeks later, right, well, I've signed you up for Boys Brigade. And it wasn't Scouts. They didn't do anything. They sat indoors and threw beanbags at each other and talked about the Bible, you know.
Signed up for Hitler Youth, it's the same thing.
This does it. We've got to say how funny this is as well, because it's really good at playing that balancing trick of going, I'm going to put funny lines in here. I felt like I'd been shot straight through the tomato, that sort of thing. But also having lines like, growing up happens in a heartbeat. And you go, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, anybody would be proud of that line. That's great.
Growing up happens in a heartbeat. One day you're in diapers. Next day you're gone. But the memories of childhood stay with you for the long haul.
And it's also the lesson that he learns with the gambling in that
that's
episode.
That's a brilliant little scene.
Yeah, and it's
a gangster movie.
Yeah, and but it's like that's his, you know, because you throw it back and you remember him as such a little kid, you know, and you've sort of seen this journey to this guy now who's a little bit of a rebel, and he's actually for the first time in that sort of last episode, he's a bit of an arsehole. It's sort of actually you're kind of like he's been your link, he's been the guy that you've always championed, and all of a sudden you're going, actually I much prefer.
But then the moment you lose sympathy for him is the moment the series is over, in a way, because he's got to be that thing, as Scott McCloud brilliantly observed about most cartoon characters have very few features. They're just two dots and a line, like Charlie Brown or Tintin or Spider-Man, because he's supposed to be you. He's supposed to be everybody.
Yeah.
And the moment he gets tall and gangly or gets a beard or something, he's going to stop being you. He's going to have his own opinions. You need him as a lump of unformed clay. Yeah. You'd better project yourself onto him. And the moment he's an arsehole, you go, well, I wouldn't do that. And then he stops being your representative and the show naturally is coasting off into the distance.
Yeah, it's leaving you, isn't it?
I think that shows like that and shows like Modern Family, it's what we do for a living. It's so nice when you see something so finely crafted, so brilliantly made.
Yep.
And it is that world where I'd love to sort of move into that genre, that family sort of sitcom genre. And I look at one of the years, I think that's they've done it better than anyone I can ever remember.
We need to wrap this up, but I'm going to do the last question because it is kind of the elephant in the barn. Do they get it together in the barn, where it cuts away from the barn?
Oh, do they?
What do you reckon?
I think that's the moment, yeah.
I think they do,
yeah,
don't
I think
they?
Yeah, I
and
think
we
they.
Just don't see it,
no,
because you don't need to see it.
And also,
it's in a barn.
Gratuitous to watch.
What do American teenagers do in barns? It's pretty
scary. I think it's... And also, and the look of it, the look on both their faces when... I mean, certainly...
Push the red button now to see explicit barn footage.
They get all straw in their bits and, oh, never mind.
This is not the show we signed up for.
Yeah. Okay, we're just going to push it a little bit here.
Because in case they ask us to come back, let's make sure we've burned all our bridges with the network.
Because you know, the really canny thing to do with the story, which maybe they did, but they were even cleverer than that, is to go, yeah, maybe we did, we're not going to tell you. But they get it together and they go, oh dear, we should have stayed friends. You know, that, because that's a very common thing, especially when you're young and kind of falling for someone, is that you have fallen for the idea of them, not the them.
Yeah, I mean, that's something weirdly I think only happens with experience, right? Any of us, you know. And I think that can happen in romance, it can happen in friendship. You can meet people that, it's the famous thing of thinking, don't meet your heroes. Because you can put someone in a place going, God, man, I bet it's really cool hanging out with them. I bet they're amazing. And then you spend 20 minutes in their company, you're like, oh, fuck.
Just people.
Yeah. God, and sometimes vile people that you're like, oh, right. Well, I'll just swerve you for the rest of my life.
Well, close the mics, Tom, so you can name names. Tom Davis, thanks for coming on Rule of Three.
Thank you for having me.
I remember a place, a town, a house, like a lot of houses. A yard like a lot of other yards. On a street, like a lot of other streets.